And it's the local news hour here on KPCW Park City. Thursday, October 30th, Halloween Eve. I'm Connor Thomas filling in for Leslie this morning. Looking at the weather, it says it's pretty cold in the 20s in Heber and Park City. With more on the weather outlook, it's ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at plenty of sunshine as we go throughout the day, but another cold start out there for us as temperatures are down into the 20s and 30s once again on this Thursday morning. We will see that sunshine helping to warm our temperatures up a little bit, but still staying below average with high temperatures only in the 50s in Park City. And if we're lucky, we may hit 60 degrees in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Halloween, a big day out there, of course, we're going to start off with those chilly temperatures right around freezing for your Friday morning in both Park City and the Heber Valley. And we'll see these temperatures very similar to today. We'll see those highs back into the mid to upper 50s in Park City with low 60s expected in the Heber Valley. Once we move into the upcoming weekend, we'll have a weak system graze northern Utah as we go throughout your Saturday. Could add a few extra clouds, but no worse than partly cloudy skies out there. Temperatures starting off around freezing Saturday morning. We'll see those highs, I think, rebounding into the low 60s in Park City and the mid 60s in the Heber Valley. Your Sunday forecast will feature more sunshine moving in behind that weak system, so no real major impacts, and we'll see those temperatures dipping down into the 30s Sunday morning with high temperatures in Park City and the mid 60s. By your Sunday afternoon, highs will be into the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Moving into next week, we've got more of the same, really. It's high pressure is just dominating the weather pattern over the next 7 to 10 days. So we'll have lots of sunshine, temperatures starting off in the 30s, highs in the mid 60s in Park City, highs in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. And we'll stick with that pattern with maybe some slightly cooler temperatures as we get towards the middle of next week. We'll call it mostly sunny skies, temperatures dipping down into the 30s for your Tuesday and Wednesday mornings. And then as we go into your Wednesday afternoon, we'll see those highs only in the low 60s in Park City and highs in the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Overall, it looks dry, very fall-like, with high pressure dominating our weather pattern as we go throughout the next 7 to 10 days. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up on the broadcast this morning, we will not be speaking with a Summit County Council member about yesterday's meeting since it was canceled. They, I'm told, missed some legal notifications and have decided to try to re-agendize everything for the November 12th meeting, as there's no meeting next week as well. Instead, we've got Stephanie Tomlin. She's the UDOT Trails Division Director, talking about the Utah Trails Network Master Plan as an aspirational network of paved trails to connect the entire state of Utah. Park City Community Foundation's Christine Coleman talks about Live PC, Give PC in studio with High West Director of Hospitality, Steve Walton. Then the Park City and Summit County Arts Council stops by to talk about this month's gallery stroll and Dia de los Muertos celebrations. The Park City Community Foundation, Arts Council, and UDOT are financial supporters of KPCW. The Wasatch County School District Board of Education was set to approve boundary delineations Tuesday night, but after public comment from dozens of community members, they opted to table the decision. KPCW's Christine Weller was there.
Deer Creek High School is under construction along State Route 113, just west of downtown Heber. With the new high school set to open in fall 2026, the Wasatch County School District has been talking about how to divide students between Wasatch High School and Deer Creek for about a year. That discussion was meant to come to a close Tuesday night after a public hearing, but after around 80 community members packed the meeting room to share their concerns, the board opted to delay a final boundary decision. The boundary up for approval uses Highway 40 as a natural boundary on the south end of the valley. At Heritage Farms Parkway, the boundary continues east to the Red Ledges private community, then heads north. Students who live east of Highway 40 would have attended Timpanogos Middle School and Wasatch High. Students to the west would have gone to Rocky Mountain Middle School and Deer Creek High. The public's biggest complaint was that the proposed boundary split Daniels Canyon and J.R. Smith Elementary students between the middle schools. Wasatch High School student Rachel Ritchie said she felt like an outsider when she was split from her friends going into middle school.
Being on the other side of the valley from my friends, it was hard to ever see anyone after school. When everyone got together at each other's houses, I was never invited because I was so far away.
In seventh grade, Ritchie said things got so bad she pretended she was sick every day so she wouldn't have to go to school. Things are better for her now in high school, but Ritchie said she's worried about her little brother, who's in fourth grade.
I don't want to see him go through that. So if you guys could please reconsider, that would be awesome.
Parent Lindy Ryu lives in the Daniels Canyon area. She agreed splitting elementary schools is not in the best interest of the kids and worried her four children, aged 10 to 16, would struggle.
They have developing bonds, they're young, they're impressionable, they're doing great, and splitting this elementary school, I think, is absolutely the wrong thing going to junior high school.
Former board member Marianne Allen lives in the Wheeler Park area. She said 99% of the area's students would go to Wasatch High under the proposed boundary, but a handful of kids would be left out. One solution is for students to apply to go to a preferred school that's outside their boundary. It's called school choice, although Allen said this isn't feasible for everyone.
Unless a parent is at home or family finances actually allow for a second or a third vehicle, the ability to get to Wasatch High is diminished if we are not in the actual boundary.
There were also concerns with safety and kids having to cross busy roads. Along with their suggestions and concerns, many parents thanked the board and district for their efforts to choose the best boundary for the community. After feedback from dozens of parents, students, and staff, the board decided to table the boundary discussion rather than vote. It's not immediately clear when the boundary will be up for approval again. However, Superintendent Garrick Peterson noted the deadline to approve new boundaries is looming. For Deer Creek to have high school sports, the Utah High School Association must know how many students will attend by mid-December. If the boundary proposal is altered significantly, another 30-day notice is required before another can be approved. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with us now from UDOT is the Trails Division Director, Stephanie Tomlin. Thanks so much for calling in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So the Utah Trails Network Initiative has released a visionary trail map this week. I want to talk about it, but maybe can you introduce listeners who aren't familiar with what the Utah Trails Network is and aims to do? What's the vision there?
Absolutely. So the Utah Trail Network, this is a program overseen by UDOT, the Utah Department of Transportation. It's really exciting. The goal of the Utah Trail Network is to create active transportation, paved trail connections that really link up the entire state of Utah. Think of this as like the interstate system of paved trails in a way. These are the backbone or spine trails that really will help people get to the destinations they need to access within their communities, but not only within their immediate communities. The goal of this program is to really connect people across boundaries to make sure that they're able to get to the things that they need to get to. Because often we don't know where jurisdictional boundaries, end. So our goal is really to think at that 30,000 foot view and create connections, all across the state.
Yeah, and from what I've read about it online, it's not just those long distance bike packers who you're trying to get from point A to point B. It's a lot of commuters as well.
That's exactly the goal of the program. Thanks, Connor. It really is about creating commuting options for people. Of course, we know these types of trails are great from a recreation standpoint, but we're the Department of Transportation. We're really trying to help people choose active transportation as a mode. So we're trying to help them choose walking, biking, or rolling to get to many of the places that they need to access. So yeah, it's, of course, there could be a benefit from a recreational standpoint and maybe even those longer distance trips, but we really are hoping people can jump on the Utah Trail Network for, maybe a couple of miles. But I think that what's really special and unique about this program is that at the DOT, we can think at that 30,000 foot view and try and think how things link up all across the state. So yes, of course, it looks like a major map all, that you could ride or walk, these great distances. It's really mostly about how those routes really play out on a community level.
And what happened this week is, as far as I can tell, this is the first time you've sort of put lines on a map for planning purposes. If people go online and look at this, it looks a little bit like capillaries over the state of Utah.
Yeah.
Can you describe, what you're thinking as far as, just the planning process now that you've decided or began the process of drawing some of these connections?
Absolutely. So why the announcement this week is significant is because we now have the guiding star, you know, the North Star, so to speak, of where UDOT will be going as we move this program along. A reminder too, this program, so we have ongoing funding. So we have $45 million a year to build out the Utah Trail Network. So since we received that funding back in 2023, we have been working really hard at developing this master plan because we want it to be very clear which routes UDOT will be focusing on in terms of construction using this Utah Trail Network funding, and which routes are really the local routes that we're hoping the local communities still pick up the mantle and work on constructing. Because in a similar way that UDOT has state routes and interstate systems for vehicles, we're imagining this as a similar, a similar kind of model where UDOT would be responsible for the construction of the regional, the spine and the backbone. And there's still obviously, there's the local routes that are really necessary in kind of tying all this together.
I guess, go ahead.
Mm-hmm, go ahead. Oh, well, that's the significance of this announcement is that we now have this map and that these will be the routes that we'll be focusing on moving forward.
Yeah, I was curious about the ongoing funding because I had seen some funding in the past. How long do you have funding for?
There's no horizon or sunset on that funding. So we have ongoing funding now into perpetuity.
All right. Well, I want to get into some of the highlights for Summit and Wasatch counties, and I'll do my best to describe this for radio purposes, I guess. But, one of the first things that sticks out is connections to the Wasatch Front, which I think makes sense from a commuter perspective. Parley's is envisioned as having some sort of multi-use trail, Provo Canyon, Weber Canyon to the north. Could you go into some of the planning processes there? Because I know, like, planning commissioners here locally have even spoken publicly about road bikers on I-80 and things like that. Where have you seen that need?
Yes. So starting with Parley's Canyon, it's certainly, I do want to emphasize, there's a lot of complexity to that canyon. That is why if your listeners are able to access the map, and we can end with how to access this map. But I do want to point out that the lower portion of the canyon is called out as a vision corridor. What that designation means for the Utah Trail Network is this will require a significant amount of, feasibility work to see if it's even possible to get a route down this section of the canyon. However, we certainly know that there are potentially alternatives, Immigration Canyon maybe, or, other areas to potentially look to if we determine that section of a multi-use trail is not possible. But it certainly is, we really understand that connection need. We hear about this quite a bit. So that's why you see it on this map. Our map is really ambitious. We're trying to show, where these networks should be, despite engineering challenges, right? So yes, we're absolutely calling it out as a vision route that we want to take a really close look at and kind of understand the engineering complexities. But it is also worth noting that it probably would be rather costly to get a multi-use trail in that location, the lower part of the canyon. So we may, if we got to the point where we deemed it feasible, we'd maybe have to look at augmenting some funding. Provo Canyon, on the other hand, there is a trail up to Vivian Park already in Provo Canyon. UDOT and its planning partners, so Mountainland Association of Governments, we already actually have the engineering plans completed to complete the trail all the way up to the dam. Unfortunately, there's some litigation occurring right now that's preventing us from moving forward into construction. But I'm just happy to report that section is, we already have kind of the engineering drawings and it's feasible and we'd love to move that forward. I think what I'd like to end on related to kind of some of these bigger canyon connections is, this what's really cool about the Utah Trail Network is we're able to think about, making those larger connections across, geographically challenging areas. And we're certainly not shying away from that, as you can see, in this map. So it's exciting. And we've heard absolutely that there's a desire for those types of connections.
Yeah, and one thing you point out is a lot of these, I mean, maybe not most of them, though, a lot of these areas that you've drawn on, there is an existing trail there.
Yes.
So you don't need to do anything. I mean, the rail trail in Park City is already there, and it looks like that's one of these lines on this map. But that also caught my eye as the rail trail continues out into like Summit County, for example. It's unpaved, and there's a big debate locally about paving or not paving that, since it sees some equestrian use, and I suppose other reasons. Could you talk about the process of, you know, if that's this line on this map, how does paving come about? And you know, is this map a end all be all of what will come? I guess.
Yeah. So, let me unpack that a bit. First off, a master plan of this scale and caliber is, of course, going to have adjustments down the road. First off, we anticipate and we will be making, revisions to this map or changes. We're planning to do that in coordination with the long-range transportation plan and the regional transportation plan. So, rest assured that they will, of course, make, you know, adjustments as things become more clear in certain areas. But that specific area of the rail trail that you're talking about, so about, you know, 248 up to 80, we have that on our map called out as a gap closure project. And so what that means is this project actually was one of the first 19 projects that we funded. This area did get some funding to do a feasibility study. So I really want to kind of emphasize that a feasibility study is exactly that. We're trying to understand where a Utah Trail Network multi-use trail should go in this area. But this exact alignment on the rail trail, it might adjust. So we're also looking at old Highway 40 in this area. But we're also, we're just trying to understand from constituents in the area the potential of paving that the section of the rail trail and understand what would be, you know, what would be the trade-offs, what would be the benefits, what would be some of the drawbacks. So a feasibility study is really an important part of the process to understand where the paved trail makes the most sense. We have it open right now for there's opportunities to comment on this. We've had public open houses to just understand some of those complexities in that area.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that would go for any feasibility study for any part of this map.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask, actually, I was looking at the map this morning and there were certain areas that caught my eye as areas where there's not a trail, and some of it seems like federal land, like there's a little gap in Zion National Park, and there's a reservation west of St. George. Could you talk about those gaps?
Sure. So we can start with Zion National Park. The section of roadway in Zion National Park, at one point, that road, SR9, actually is tunneled, and it has to go, the road itself is tunneled. That is an incredibly old tunnel, and it already is kind of feeling the effects of new vehicle sizes and widths and heights. So we were being pragmatic in this instance of there would be no feasible way to have a multi-use trail kind of in that area. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that area and have seen those switchbacks that then turn into a tunnel. So yes, I understand it looks like a gap. That one is certainly due to kind of constructability constraints. But we are proposing, you know, the existing trail that's in the area, continue through Springdale and really get people connected to the park. And additionally, I think what's exciting about our route is we're proposing a route all along SR9 so that someone could, you know, feasibly stay maybe in Hurricane or Laverkin or Tokerville and then ride maybe an e-bike and access Zion National Park, really helping with some of the road congestion that's already occurring in this area. So that is the reason for that gap. So many, and then the other gap, it's similar, trying to access the reservation, while also understanding that we would need to we'd need to collaborate with our partners on the reservation to see if that could potentially if we could loop that and make it eliminate that gap there.
Yeah, and it, you know, it seems like you didn't try and envision what it would take to cross like the Colorado at like Glen Canyon or something like that. That's a pretty wide expanse of desert where there's no, I guess there's no population, because I think some of the goals that I've seen is, what's the stat? 95% of the state will live within some distance of these trails?
1 mile. Yeah, 90% of the population will live within 1 mile. Yeah, I think what you're alluding to here is a really good point to, again, emphasize, which is the goal of this program is to really help people, you know, residents and visitors. And of course, like there are actually call outs on the U.S. bike routes for routes that would continue in some of the more rural parts of the state. But that's really emphasizing recreation. And our purpose, again, is to help people connect to, you know, things like schools, hospitals, grocery stores, and things like that. And of course, you're seeing a lot of ambitious routes, but the core emphasis of our program is to help people to access the things that they need. So that's why you're not seeing some of those bigger more recreation routes called out on this map.
Yeah, but you mentioned some of the nationwide bike routes. Will this be able to be part of, I forget the name, but is it the Trails Across America initiative?
There could be. Yeah, that does sound familiar. The ones that we coordinated with as we developed this map was the United States Bicycle Route, which is a program collaboration with Adventure Cycling. So, yeah, I there are some locations where there's overlap. So we're excited about that. But we also, I think, you know, our charge was just really different around making sure that it was, making sure it was connecting, you know, people to the destinations that they need to access. A great example of that is if you look down in the Moab area, we have a trail, called out, that connects to Castle Valley along Highway 128. We don't propose that trail actually continuing along 128 because Castle Valley is really where there's now a lot of residential area. People actually live in Castle Valley and then commute into Moab. So that's a perfect example. Like we could have potentially continued that route along 128, but we felt this is where the people are and they're trying to access Moab for groceries and, you know, to get to their job. So that's really the extent of that route.
And they can do it with e-bikes. I have to cut us off. I think we're almost out of time, but you know, any other things that you wanted to highlight about the Utah Trail Network, maybe how people can access this map?
Absolutely. So people can find the map and all the information. I want to, I guess, end with saying that this master plan was not created in a vacuum. We worked extensively with our planning partners and stakeholders all across the state of Utah. And you can learn more information about the master plan as well as kind of where we're heading next now that we have this map. The website is utahtrailnetwork.udot.utah.gov. So we're excited to keep working on projects and, get some of these on the ground.
All right. We've been speaking with Stephanie Tomlin from the Trails Division of UDOT. Thanks so much again.
Thank you so much.
Candidates for Park City Government have turned in their final campaign spending update ahead of the November 4th election. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the mayoral candidates are running the most expensive campaigns.
With less than a week until Election Day, the two candidates for Park City's next mayor have each raised over $45,000 for their campaigns. Councilmember Ryan Dickey has raised over $50,000 in his run for mayor and has spent most of it. Jack Rubin is close behind Dickey in fundraising with about $46,000 in contributions. However, he has spent less than half of that money so far, a little over $17,000. Jeremy Rubel, Tana Tolley, and Diego Zagara are in the race for two seats on the Park City Council. Zagara, a political newcomer, is far outspending each of the council incumbents seeking second terms. He's fundraised about $41,000 and spent nearly $35,000. Councilmember Jeremy Rebell has spent a little over $19,000 on his run for re-election, and Councilmember Tana Tolley is running the least expensive campaign in Park City, with about $11,000 in campaign expenses so far. Former council candidate John Kenworthy withdrew from the race in September. His name is still on the ballot, but votes for him will not be counted. For details about all the candidates' financial disclosures, visit kbcw.org. Election Day is November 4th. Grace Dorfler, KBCW News.
And candidates for Heber City government have also turned in their campaign spending reports. Heidi Franco and Scott Phillips are competing to be Heber's next mayor. Councilmember Scott Phillips is running a significantly more expensive race than his rival, with over $36,000 spent on his campaign this year. Mayor Heidi Franco has spent less than half that amount in her bid for a second term, around $16,000. Four candidates are in the race for two Heber City Council seats: Councilmember Yvonne Barney, Nick Lopez, Morgan Murdoch, and Corey Noyes. Murdoch leads the overall spending by far, with over $12,000 for his campaign. The other three candidates landed in the $2,000 to $2,500 range for campaign expenses that include websites, yard signs, and voter mailers. For more details and, of course, Election Day information, visit kpcw.org. Well, it is that time of the year again in Park City. Live PC, Give PC, and here to talk about the, we might as well call it a holiday next week, we have Christine Coleman, VP of Marketing at Community Foundation, and Steve, oh geez, I've not got your last name here.
Walton.
Steve Walton, the High West Director of Hospitality. Thanks so much for joining me in studio.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So, Christine, maybe you can start off with an explanation for newcomers to town of why they will see so much orange next week.
Sure, Connor. Thanks so much for referring to it as a holiday. You know, I moved here 50 years ago with my family, which is so crazy. And this is absolutely one of my favorite times of year in Park City and Summit County. It is the day that everybody gets together, the whole community, and I'm not exaggerating when I say the whole community, to give a little bit to all the local nonprofits that help us here. The nonprofits really, really ensure that our community is vibrant and thriving. So it helps the locals, the workforce, kids, seniors, definitely newcomers, part-timers, visitors all benefit from the many programs that nonprofits provide to us. Participating nonprofits do things like they focus on the arts and education and healthcare, animal welfare, the environment, recreational programs, sports, you name it. Basically, everybody who lives here, stays here, plays here, works here, we all benefit from it. And I'd say, especially for newcomers, it's a really nice way to get to know the community. The nonprofits here are so welcoming. They have lots of different events. They really want you to get to know their organizations. They offer volunteer opportunities. And so nonprofits really love it when newcomers can get involved, because we want you to be part of the community.
And generally the way it works is you'll kind of have a centralized giving area website set up, and you'll see kind of a leaderboard there and all the different icons for all the various nonprofits that you're talking about. So you can pick and choose which ones you want to give your dollars to. How many are participating this year?
Yeah, so this year there are 140 nonprofits participating, and that's a lot, of course. And I highly recommend, if you're giving for Live PC, Give PC for the first time, to go onto the website, spend a couple minutes exploring, and think of a cause that really excites you, and use the search bar. Like, for example, if you're concerned about affordable housing here in our area, you can search on housing, and all the organizations that focus on housing will come up. If you love horses, search on horses. All of those organizations will come up. There's also a filter that you can use that filters the nonprofits by their various issue areas. So that's an easy way to explore.
And giving, what's the giving window? It goes all the way until midnight. I think there's some sort of midnight deadline on Friday, November 7th.
So early giving is actually open now. I always tell people, like, if you're not going to be here next Friday on November 7th, you can give now. The nonprofits love that. We encourage people to give on the 7th, because that's when nonprofits are able to receive prizes and they're competing to get some of those prizes. And we have our amazing sponsors like High West that contribute to those prizes. And it all happens on the 7th. But like I said, if you want to give now, you're more than welcome to do that.
And Steve, I take it that High West will be hosting the party on the 7th at the end of the day again?
That is correct, yes. Yeah, one of the highlights of the year for us. It's where the community gets together and we all get to hang out and have a great time. Party begins at 8 o'clock, runs to about midnight. Midnight is when they do the big reveal of how much has been raised, and then that's the real crescendo to the end of the event. But 8 to midnight at the Saloon on Park City. Super excited. We love to be part of this event, the big community event. Like you say, it's become a kind of a holiday. You drive around Park City on Friday the 7th, and there's people on street corners, banners, stuff, like putting stuff together. It's awesome. One of the big things that we're super excited about this year, in addition to being a sponsor and hosting the after party, is this year there's a High West have sponsored the Spirit Challenge Awards. Excuse the pun. And two organizations that show the most creativity, dedication, and energy on the Friday of Live PC, Give PC will earn an extra $1,000 grant, kind of courtesy of High West. So it gives them a little extra boost of $1,000, the people that show the most creativity, dedication, and fun on the event. So this is something new for us this year. So we're really excited to be part of that as well as the party. Next Friday, the 7th, is just a fun event for the town in general. And High West is always stoked to be part of this big event every year.
And that's interesting. What are you going to be looking for as you judge, since people go to the street corners, they do social media campaigns, any and all of the above, and how are you going to judge that award?
So we really have folks out and about in the community checking everything out, not just on the day, but beforehand. Yeah, people are on the street corners, but there's nonprofits doing really creative work behind the scenes that they're making visible to us, our staff, and our task force, our Live PC, Give PC task force, and our board at the Community Foundation. So we'll be looking at all of that. I am so, so excited that we have High West continuing as one of our most amazing sponsors. And I really also want to thank Park City Mountain Vail Resort's Epic Promise for being our presenting sponsor. This year, we also have Whedon Ranch, Slopeside Village, Woodward, JP Morgan, and many others. And all of these nonprofits provide cash that helps Park City Community Foundation run Live PC, Give PC, and that also contributes to the prizes like Steve was talking about. This year, we have $47,000 worth of cash prizes that go to nonprofits who really get the most donors. Like the Spirit Award is a little bit different. That's all about spirit, but all of the prizes are based on the number of donors that they get. And what that means is that when you're a donor, you can give a $5 gift, and that's really important to the nonprofits because it helps them increase their donor total and get prizes. A $5 gift actually might not seem that significant, but it really can be. Like, for example, I usually give to a handful of nonprofits that I love. I give a smaller gift. I can't really afford to give some huge, huge gift, but it gets leveraged. So a lot of nonprofits have matching gifts. So if I give $5, it can be matched, and that turns into $10. If I give during one of the power hours that will be announced that day, it gets a $10 boost, which means my $5 gift turns into $20, which is really significant for nonprofits, especially at this moment in time where there are many programs that are being hard hit by the loss of federal funds and dealing with financial uncertainty. So this is a very important time to support the nonprofits that provide so many services for us.
No, we wouldn't know anything about that here.
Right, yeah, KPCW has been hit in a huge way.
But you mentioned the Power Hours. Who's matching that? Is that the Community Foundation matching those gifts? How does that work?
The Power Hours are actually supported by Park City Mountain Vail Resort's Epic Promise.
Cool. I'm curious, is that early giving window, as you mentioned, is open? Is that kind of contemporaneous, I guess, with how the nonprofits themselves can start reporting, like the number of donors, the dollar amounts? Is that the same as the early giving window?
Yes, it all comes in together. So this day happens online. It happens primarily online. I will say, if somebody wants to give and they don't feel like giving online, nonprofits will gladly accept offline gifts, like a check, for example, and all of those still go up towards their totals for the giving day.
Yeah, and I went online and I saw there are some new leaderboards that are marked as new this year. If you're on your way to school right now, a school teams and clubs leaderboard, one for small nonprofits, and the one for Eastern Summit County. So nonprofits who primarily serve Eastern Summit County, I take it you don't necessarily have to be based there, but you know, you can win a prize in all these various categories. Could you talk about the category awards?
Yeah, so we've got categories that are around issue areas. They include education, arts and culture, mental and physical health. Mental health is a huge issue here in our town. People and community, sports and recreation, the Small But Mighty Nonprofit Board, which you mentioned, Connor, is new. So those are for smaller nonprofits that have revenue under $250,000 a year. The Eastern Summit County nonprofits are really serving folks who, I think we said 50% of their services need to be focused on Eastern Summit County, and we've been really pleasantly surprised to have so many nonprofits on that leaderboard, and the schools and teams clubs. So the schools are getting very involved this year, more than they have in quite a while. The schools, really all ages, kids are learning about what it means to be kind in the context of giving, you know, to do good, be good in this community. This is a great way to be good when we're all experiencing challenging times.
And I should have asked this when we were talking about the particularities of this year and giving. You know, do you see any trends with, you know, the way the national economic environment is going? Do you have a prediction for how much money you'll raise compared to last year? And could you remind us what the total was last year? Because it always hits the millions.
Thanks for asking. So this year is our 15th Live PC, Give PC.
Congratulations.
And yeah, I cannot believe that our nonprofit community has been doing this for 15 years. It's amazing. And we have some goals. So the primary goal is to get 7,150 donors. We chose that number because of the 1-5 in it for 15 years. And we will get $5.15 million at minimum. I think that that's going to happen. We've got a really generous community, and all of these small gifts collectively add up. So that's what the goal is. 7,150 folks giving isn't that much when you think of the population of Greater Park City. I think we can absolutely do that.
Definitely. Well, we've, you know, been speaking about Live PC, Give PC with the Community Foundation and sponsor High West. Is there anything else that y'all want to talk about this morning?
Yes, Steve, do you want to talk about the party for all ages?
Yes, yeah. So we have the party for all ages is happening at the Park City Library, and that happens earlier in the evening. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that there's an opportunity for everybody to get involved in Live PC, Give PC. Our High West event is 21 and above, so we wanted to make sure that there's availability and opportunity for everyone to get involved. So over at the Park City Library, 5 to 7?
It's actually 4 to 6.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And Steve, I don't mean to bring up a competitor, but I heard there's overflow at Oshuck's White House this year.
I wouldn't think of it so much as a competitor, but it does get a little packed. This is a really popular party.
It is. And my best advice is to come early. You know, I mean, there generally is a line down the road. Once we get to our max capacity, because obviously we have to make sure that we're compliant, it is one in, one out, and most people want to be around for the midnight drop and understand how well the event has raised. So, you know, my biggest advice is to come early, enjoy the evening, but the doors open at 8 o'clock to the public, and it does become a very, very popular event for the community. And there, the White House, or Oshuck's White House, does have an event going that evening. So if I'm unable to get in, maybe go over there, grab a cocktail, and come back and check on the status of the event. But it is, you know, the biggest advice is to get there early because it is a very popular community event. And we only have, unfortunately, so much space.
I'm sure the fire department will thank you.
And check out the event schedule on the website, livepcgivepc.org. It has a list of all of the different nonprofits that are doing parties that night. A lot of them have little fundraising events that they're doing at places around the kind of lower Main Street area, and then folks come on over to High West and see if they can get in, and it's going to be really fun. So excited.
Uber home, everybody.
Definitely.
All right, Christine Coleman, Steve Walton, thank you so much for coming on the Local News Hour.
Thanks
for having us.
In the studio now from the Park City and Summit County Arts Council, we've got Kendall Kelly and Andrea Zavala. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Connor. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, you know, that was unanimous. Wow. So coming up, we've got another holiday, but this one's before. Is it tomorrow, Dia de los Muertos? Does it coincide with Halloween? How does this work? I don't know the differences.
The event is on Saturday, but the tradition runs from the 28th to the 2nd, if I'm not mistaken, yeah.
All right, so you've got an event with the Arts Council. Where is it, when is it, and who do you hope attends?
It'll be at our gallery, Create PC, on 1500 Kearns Boulevard, and it's on Saturday from 2 to 5 p.m., and we hope the entire community comes, even if you are not really sure about what Dia de Muertos is, because it's a really, I think, a very rooted tradition that most of us should know about. And just, it's a tradition that connects us to the nature, life, and death. And it's just interesting. And I think if you don't know much about it, it'll open your curiosity and you might want to find more about it.
And I think art seems to be very central to the tradition. It conjures up, I see these fantastic parades that they do and like lots of skulls and... It's not so scary. It's really quite beautiful, some of the stuff that
it is. I talked to someone yesterday about the event, and she's like, oh my God, it's so scary. And I'm like, no, it's actually really nice. I'm not Mexican, and so I had to learn more about it. And the more you read and find out about the tradition, it's really magical, I think, and very spiritual. And so it's not about death. It's actually about life and to celebrate and honor the people that are not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm. I also would say it's really nice, an opportunity for you to be able to bring something by Create PC before the event. And it's an ofrenda where you're able to have a photo or something that reminds you of this loved one that you've lost. And you're able to have this time to remember them and think about them.
We have two artists that are going to install the ofrenda. And so if you have your grandma or someone really special that you want to honor and remember that day, you can bring the photo or something that reminds you of that person.
Yeah, and it says some sweet treats, some tamales, sugar skull decorating, and this will be free. Do you need to sign up anywhere? You can kind of just come to the Create PC there, kind of behind Tupelo.
Tupelo, yeah. Yep. It is free, open to the public. You don't need to sign up or register. We'd love for you to just come by. So it is going to be activities and the food. I will say the food will probably go quick. So tamales were a hot hit last year. Pan de Muerto is a traditional bread that will be available. We'll have hot chocolate. It's just definitely something that you want to come sooner than later, but we'll be there till 5.
Till 5.
And then tomorrow... On Halloween, you'll have a gallery stroll kind of coinciding with Halloween on Main and all the festivities there. This should be a festive one.
Yes, so gallery stroll this week, the whole association decided to coincide with the trick-or-treating on Main Street. So a lot of the galleries on Main Street will be open and available for everyone to come in, get candy, similar to the other businesses. You will also be able to come to Create PC over on Kearns Boulevard and do the same. So even though we're off Main Street and it's not the traditional, if you're on your way and you're on the bus and you want to stop by or come by afterwards, you're more than welcome to come there and grab some candy as well.
And there are, you know, galleries off of Main Street too. Are they going to be participating in this one?
I can't guarantee that. I know for sure that we will be, but the other entities, I'm assuming they'll be open and available, but I would definitely guarantee the spots on Main Street will for sure be open and available and handing out candy alongside all the other businesses. So it's a great time to be able to check out some of the galleries, see what they have going on. In addition to all the fun costumes on Main Street, I'm sure everyone's looking forward to the traditional Halloween parade, not parade, but you know, just trek down Main Street or up.
It's awesome. I love getting into the holidays, and it says, you know, as you're transitioning into the holidays over at the Create PC Gallery, you will transform back into the Holiday Makers Market. Second year running, third year running?
So it is the second year of the Holiday Makers Market in this iteration. So obviously we've done a lot of different versions of this over the years. I'm really excited about the fact that we're going to have our second year at this location. I think people will be able to find us really easily. They know that we're there. They know a lot of what we have going on and available. We'd love for folks to be able to do sippin' shops with us again this year. But I want to digress and go back to the fact that the Holiday Makers Market is a really exciting time to really highlight so many more creatives in the area, because our traditional gallery, it's harder to have as many participants, but for the Makers Market, we have looking about 75 participants that we're going to be having displaying their creative goods and work. And so it's something that will be open from November 22nd until January. And so we'll have a launch party happening on November 21st from 6 to 9 p.m. That is always a really fun party. We're going to have a DJ. We'll have food. It's a big group of people where everyone gets to come in and see a first look and or first grabs at all of the goods. So you want to get in before some of the things that you love or are excited to see go away.
Yeah, and I because it's a maker's market, it's not just art, from what I understand, some consumables like some soaps or maybe some food.
Yes, cookies. Absolutely. Cookies and soap.
Chocolates.
We have a couple vendors that are going to be coming from the Latino Arts Festival that participated. We have folks that are going to be doing, they have knitwear and they have canned goods and they have candles and we have the artwork. We have just like such a variety and it is really such a great easy location to get gifts for the holidays and be able to support your local entrepreneurs.
Is it too late for artists or makers to sign up?
Unfortunately, it is. The deadline was last Friday, and it's a popular one, so you got to get in and apply. But we really did do our best to let in as many people as we possibly could, and we always want to encourage folks that if you didn't get into this one, apply for the Create PC Gallery participation throughout the rest of the year, and then apply next year. We do a lot of things throughout the year to where we're hoping those opportunities come up regularly and don't feel like you've missed out.
All right. Anything else that y'all want to mention today?
So I would just say for the Holiday Makers Market, it's something that we want everyone to know that this is an ongoing and exciting thing that you can participate in a lot of different ways. Last year, we had a lot of really fun sip-in shops, as I was mentioning, where you're able to book it for an evening and bring your group in, have some light bites, bring everyone in for an evening of shopping and having your own little celebration. And so we'd love to tell people that that's something that you're able to do. Is there anybody in particular that you're excited about seeing this Holiday Makers Market, Andrea?
The Holiday Makers Market on the cookies, the chocolate. Cookies are delicious. Mm-hmm.
Lots of treats. And then we also have, this weekend, there's quite a few things happening just around town. We're excited for Egyptian Theater has Rocky Horror Show premiering at the theater this weekend.
Saw it last night.
Oh, fun. Awesome.
They did a great job.
Oh, good. And then I know Park City Film has a couple cool shows. They're showing Pan's Labyrinth tonight. And then you can catch a show, Peacock, over the weekend. Both of those are foreign cinema films that they're featuring.
All right. Awesome. All right. We've been speaking with the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County, Andrea Zavala and Kendall Kelly. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Colin.
Thanks.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation President and CEO Colin Hilton's being honored for his work to preserve and advance Utah's Olympic and winter sports heritage. KPCW's Christine Weller has this report.
Hilton grew up in western New York. Every morning as a kid, he hoped snow would cancel school so he could ski and play outside.
I was a ski tech at a ski rental shop just outside of Kissing Bridge, a little hill in western New York, and I've always loved winter sport, but sport in general.
He later served in key roles for the FIFA World Cup Soccer Tournament and the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. And when Utah's Winter Games team needed help from experienced people in 2002, Hilton headed to the Wasatch Mountains and never left. He ended up at the helm of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation after telling leadership more needed to be done to encourage locals to use the facilities.
I guess I kept making those comments enough that they said, why don't you come and right the ship? I think the biggest influence that I recognized was a need to not just run facilities, but to run the programs in the facilities and hire the coaches, the instructors, and do what we call a living legacy of active uses.
The foundation's facilities include the Utah Olympic Park in Park City, the Soldier Hollow Nordic Center in Midway, and the Utah Olympic Oval in Kearns. And the venues now get a lot of traffic. According to the foundation, the facilities attract over 500,000 visitors annually, generating more than $130 million each year. The venues also support over 1,000 jobs, $78 million in GDP, and $132 million in industry output. After running the foundation for 19 years, Hilton is being recognized for his visionary leadership. He was presented with the S.J. Quinney Award Wednesday by Ski and Snow Sports Archives Board Chair Barbara Yamada. Christine Weller, KPCW News.